Let's take a look back at 1981 in a program we did on health and food.
How do you like your meat? Raw? Medium? Well done? Radioactive? Well, food scientists working in industry laboratories have found that by bombarding meat with radioactivity, they can extend the shelf life. Well, we won't be serving up any meat tonight. Maybe a little bologna, but we will be having a bit of a TV dinner here on Alternative Views News Magazine. Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. Food may be dangerous to your health. At least that's what a Senate committee concluded when they looked at what Americans are eating. They found that the modern American diet, fat, rich, sugar-soaked, and chemically treated, is, according to the committee chairman, deadly. Tonight, we'll try to provide some answers as to why the food we are eating is killing us. We'll have a film, Eat, Drink and Be Wary, and a discussion of the film with food specialist Jack Schierenbeck.
But before we have our program on food and health, which, by the way, will include a cameo appearance by Jim Hightower, we'll have some news stories from alternative sources.
What has happened in Colombia as a result of the drug operations there is just incredible and such a tragedy. The country is just practically ungovernable. There's almost continuous civil war all over the country. And a very significant thing has happened there, and that is the drug lords have so much power, economically as well as militarily. They've been killing off people for years there. The guerrillas, when they could find them, the liberal and left-wing politicians, and the conservative politicians. But these are just politicians. But now they have escalated, and they even kidnapped Andres Pastrana. Well, what's so special about Andres Pastrana? Well, he would be the equivalent of a Rockefeller in the United States. You can kill a lot of, you know, just middle-level, maybe high-level politicians in the United States, but once you touch the Rockefellers, then you're really, touching home. So this is really upset the ruling class in Colombia, because they've been ruling there for many, many, many years. And they have let the drug cartel, you know, kind of do what they want to do so long as they leave their elite social and political power structure alone. But now the drug cartel is so powerful that they're beginning to take over the whole thing. As a matter of fact, there are the private armies of these drug barons that not only are controlling large areas of Colombia, but there are large areas where nobody is in control. It's absolute chaos, civil war, and even the landowners as well as the workers have fled these areas.
Frank, I have several friends in Colombia who are intellectuals, college professors, publishers, and periodically I've been getting letters from them about how horrendous the situation is for intellectuals in that country, that some of the leading critics of the Colombian government disappear, and all you have to do is to criticize the Colombian government or to make some demands to stop the drug trafficking, and you're taking your life in your hands. So this is completely disruptive. disrupted the intellectual life of the country. Top professors and journalists and writers are forced to flee the country, and it's just simply impossible to have any political discussion or debate in this country because of the extent to which thugs from the drug cartel control the country.
The key to it, according to this article in The Nation, is that the drug lords want guarantees that they will not be extradited to the United States. There was a law that Colombia had where they would extradite these people. So they go around killing everybody until they make sure that nobody gets extradited. And their claim, of course, is that the main problem is in the United States. If the Americans would do something about the usage of cocaine and other hard drugs like heroin, then there wouldn't be the problem. But in the meanwhile, poor Colombia is bleeding to death.
Well, election 88 is off and running, and everyone has observed that in the first primaries, the initial primaries of the season, the candidates who could afford the most TV advertising generally did the best, highlighting once again the importance of television in the presidential elections in the United States. Well, Super Tuesday is coming on today, in fact, as we tape this. The Super Tuesday voting is going on. And because there were so many different states in that primary date, none of the candidates, even the most well-heeled one, could afford television advertising in all of those states. So a new TV strategy emerged. And that is that the major candidates of both the Republican and the Democratic Party simply fly around the Super Tuesday primary states from one airport after another, hold brief press conferences, hop on the plane again, fly to the next city, and do another press conference, and so on through the day. The strategy is to get on the TV news that night. Evidently, local affiliate news personnel like to have their contact with the heavies that are running for the presidential election role, and therefore they turn up at the airport every time one of these turkeys lands, and a bunch of cameras come out and TV machines or video recorders are rolling. And this is a good way to get free exposure on television news that night. They think that just getting their image on television news keeps them in the race, and if they can make a 10 or 20 second statement, so much the better. So this is what's going on. The New York Times on March the 3rd documented this by flying around with some of the candidates. They joined Pat Robertson as he hit one Florida city after another. And then they did some research and pointed out that he got on television almost every time that he landed in an airport in Florida. The different local affiliates were there and recorded his brief press conferences and showed it on the air that night, so it seems to be working. Likewise, they followed Senator Albert Gore as he hopped from one Kentucky city to another, and followed Bob Dole of Kansas, who was hopping from Tennessee to Oklahoma, making these brief press conferences in the airport. So this is a new kind of campaigning, airport press conferencing. So less and less are these guys able to really circulate among the people and talk to actual human beings. They seem to be playing more and more for the television cameras in the hope of getting their faces on the news that night.
There was an article in the Dallas newspaper over the weekend in which the guy was listing the pluses and minuses of each of the candidates. And after all was said and done, he figured that the person with the strongest attraction and the best chance that the Americans really want is a white Jesse Jackson.
Actually, Jesse Jackson will be an interesting test to this theory that television advertising and exposure is the key determinant, because obviously he doesn't have the money for television advertising. He's the only major candidate that has not have a TV advertising budget. Plus, he's the candidate that does the least of this airport hopping and does more city hopping. I mean, he addresses different groups of individuals in the towns and the states that he's campaigning in. So it'll be really interesting if he can sort of break this implicit presupposition that you got to have television advertising and coverage to do well in American political campaigns.
There
this
was
will be a test.
Yeah, there was also another story in a Dallas newspaper that somebody recorded. There was a there was a conversation which a couple of farmers had in Iowa, somewhere in the Midwest, farmers whose land were being taken away from them. They'd been talking, Jesse Jackson had addressed their problems, they'd been talking to him, and these two farmers, one of them said, "Hey, you know, Jesse Jackson, he's a man for me." He said, "I like the way he talks." And his friend said, "Yeah, but Jesse's black, you know." He said, "Yeah, but look, he's the only one who's going to have a farm program, he's going to have a moratorium on taking away our land, he's going to do something for us." And the guy said, "Yeah, but he's black, I couldn't vote for him." And the first farmer said, "I think you're missing my point. The man who's taking our land away from us is a white man."
That's funny. So maybe race will be relativized as the real issues emerge. Well, we can't have a discussion of the election without an attack on the Republicans. And it appeared that George Bush evidently quoted John Lennon once, "Let's give peace a chance." And upon hearing that, Jack Kemp, upon George Bush's reappropriation of John Lennon, the Beatle commented, "This is embarrassing to have a Republican talking about give peace a chance."
And they used to call the Democrats the party of war, remember?
Right.
This pattern of tragedy and absolutely needless waste of lives and human potential that is perpetrated by the United States and its allies, particularly through the CIA, it's going again in the Philippines. According to the Covert Action Information Bulletin, the recent proliferation of armed terrorist vigilante groups in the Philippines appears to be linked to retired General John Singlaub's relocation to the Philippines last November. Of course, Singlaub has had CIA connections for a long time and is also one of the big dogs in the World Anti-Communist League, or the WACL. But we see the usual actors which we've noticed in Latin America, for instance, the AFL-CIO organization, AIFLD. Well, it has a little bit different name. It's called the Asian American Free Labor Institute, AAFLI. But once again, it's allied with the right-wing unions that were set up by Fernando Marcos in 1975, and this is used as a conduit for CIA money. There are other people which we see popping up over there that, same as we've seen in Central America, the religious right is very strong. The Muni organization, CAUSA, or CAUSA, I've never heard it pronounced. I don't know which
CAUSA.
It is. CAUSA, that's how they do it. Anyway, they're very strong over there, as well as some of the, like, Christian Anti-Communist Crusade. And these people are all interconnected in this far-right Nazi and fascist network, which the Covert Action Information has talked about for quite a bit of time. And in addition to this, we see the large corporations, some of them, particularly the right-wing supporters like the owner of Schick and Papermate Corporation, the J. Howard Pugh family and their trusts. Prentice Hall Corporation printed a lot of stuff for them for free and helped them out. And what is happening is that a lot of these vigilante groups, some of them which are just armed gangs by certain particular semi-warlords, you might say, but they have become organized and coordinated since General Singlaub went over there. And they have been embraced as well by Corazon Aquino. In May of 1987, at the request of the Philippine Alliance for Human Rights Advocates, a U.S. fact-finding delegation headed by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark visited the Philippines, and they investigated the maintenance and formation and operation of these vigilante groups. And the delegation found ample evidence to indicate that the United States, indeed, U.S. governmental agencies, as well as some of these private organizations, are in fact playing a crucial role in counterinsurgency and these right-wing death squads in the Philippines. Same old act.
That's all the time we have for news stories from the Alternative Press. Now let's turn to the centerpiece of our program, food and health.
Thank you.
start them out warm and happy and satisfied.
Anyway, is one of the great pleasures in life. I love it. I love to eat. I like to fix big dinners for my friends and have a good time and eat. But you don't have to eat things that are bad for you in order to have things that are succulent and tasty and wonderful. If you haven't tasted a lot of things in their natural state, you should run right out and do it because it's great. I mean, it's really fantastic. And it's a shame that so many people miss out on that because of so-called convenience foods.
The character of our food supply has changed considerably in the past 25 years. Until 1950, we had essentially an agricultural food supply, that is, a situation where food was grown by the farmer, taken to the market, bought unchanged by the housewife, and cooked and prepared for a family. Since 1950, and increasingly since 1960, we have developed, pushed on to us, an industrial food supply, that is, one where foods were more and more processed, and where instead of the food as grown being sold, the food was, in a sense, mined, and entirely new foods made from it.
Processing of food itself is not a new idea. But new methods of processing are changing our eating habits with factory foods in bewildering numbers.
Many of the modern foods, so-called modern foods, are not nearly as nutritious as the old-fashioned fresh fruits and vegetables and other products we got from the farm. Many of these foods are high in sugar, high in salt. In a number of cases, nutrients have been removed from the foods. And when you add this up, the nutritional content of the American diet has actually deteriorated in recent years. Things are getting worse, not better.
Today, though we can buy good food, our diets are worse than they were 10 years ago. Too many of us have health problems because we eat poorly. Too many non-nutritious foods, too few vitamins and minerals.
This bread that I'm making right now is made with whole wheat flour, which is just stone ground, and honey and milk and some added wheat germ. So, it'll be a good bread. I mean, it'll not only taste really delicious, but it'll be a really useful and good food. Whereas white bread that you buy in the store or white bread that you make yourself out of refined, white flour that's had the wheat germ removed and the bran removed is almost entirely starch.
As food is processed, nutrients are usually removed. The milling of grain is a glaring example. Most of the minerals and vitamins in a wheat kernel are on the surface and the bran and outer layers and in the growing center, called the wheat germ. Flour made from the complete wheat kernel, whole wheat flour, contains these nutritious parts of the wheat. But most flour is ground further to make white flour. In making white flour, the wheat germ and bran are removed, and the major portions of many minerals and vitamins are lost. Part of the protein and most of the fiber are also lost. The bran and outer layers are sold for cattle feed, and our well-nourished pets get the wheat germ. When a bread company makes white bread, they put back a few of the lost nutrients. advertising then tells us how good the bread is for us because it is enriched. What they don't say is that enriched bread contains only a few of the original nutrients. Happily, you don't have to buy white bread. Most stores have a variety of nutritious whole grain breads.
There's supposed to be more wheat in a whole wheat than in bleached white flour, yeah. But it's hard to have faith in anything anymore. But I buy wheat. Wheat bread is really good for you.
White bread tastes gummy.
If you get a wheat bread like this, well, you get more vitamins, more nutrition, more everything in it than you would if you bought a white bread, which is blah. It's nothing. It's taking everything out.
Many states don't even require enrichment for some flour products. The nutritional loss from snacks, pastries, and donuts may be almost total. Rice is another one of the grains from which we manage to remove most of the nutritious elements by taking off the outer layers. Enriched white rice has had several vitamins and iron restored. But brown rice, whole grain rice that has not been milled, has all the original nutrients. The rice, which advertisers urge us to eat, is even less nutritious than white rice. After making instant rice, food companies attempt to make up for the loss of nutrients by dusting the grains with a vitamin powder. Such highly processed foods are increasingly replacing more nutritious foods in our diet.
But yeah, I like things like this, like all these hamburger helper things and Rice-A-Roni and all that. It tastes good and I can just fix it real fast without having to worry when I get home from work, what am I going to do? It just cooks up in 5 minutes, I feed it to everybody and that's it.
We usually buy stuff that tastes good and stuff that we like the taste of, and I think that in the long run it probably works out all right. It's all food, isn't it?
Because of possible long-term consequences to our health, I think the more we hang on to fairly unprocessed foods and the less we let our food supply be invaded by overprocessed foods, the better it would be for all of us.
Not only good for you, but fantastically delicious. It's going to be great to eat. And that's the thing about whole grains, is that they're always not only much, much better for you than grains that are tampered with, but always, without exception, much more delicious. So, you know, what more can you say?
Hydrogenated vegetable oil, sugar,
sodium caseinate, sorbitol. Oh, what is all this stuff?
I don't know. Sodium sterol 2, lactylate, light.
Sodium caseinates, mono and diglycerides, dipotassium phosphate, sodium.
Along with the shift in the last 20 years to highly refined and processed foods, there has been an enormous increase in the use of food additives.
Artificial colors.
A typical instant mashed potato package has potatoes, but also these ingredients. A breakfast cake has sugar, flour, water, and shortening, but also a packaged salad dressing has all these ingredients. There are dyes, buffers, bleaches, emulsifiers, preservatives, flavorers, moisturizers, and so forth.
Whipped cream doesn't have milk in it or anything. That whipped cream is supposed to have milk in it.
One reason companies like to use these additives is because it helps sales and profits. Using preservatives, emulsifiers, and stabilizers, food manufacturers can concoct completely new products like pudding cups. BHA and BHT are added to potato chips, so packages can sit on the shelf for 3 months without going stale. Artificial flavors are used in ice cream because they're much cheaper than natural flavors. Caramel coloring makes white bread look like whole wheat bread. Egg bread is dyed yellow to make it look rich in eggs. and a frozen breakfast drink imitates real orange juice with the aid of an orange dye.
It's all imitation of the real thing, let's face it. And there's nothing, you know, that's as beautiful, finally, as the real thing.
There is controversy over the use of some additives, however, because they are potentially dangerous to our health.
It's not necessarily the case that additives are always bad. That certainly isn't true. Many additives serve useful purposes. For instance, the addition of vitamin D to milk is very useful. Adding iodine to salt has been very useful in preventing goiter. However, we have to be very careful about additives, because if it turns out that any one additive turns out to be very dangerous, that could mean harm for a tremendous number of people. And down through the years, many additives have been found to be dangerous, and most of these have been artificial colorants. So I think if there's any worry, we should be worrying about artificial colorants. They've been found to cause allergic reactions, cancer in animals, and damage of several internal organs like liver and heart in animals.
One controversial food dye that was once widely used is red number two. It was the most common of all food dyes. All of us consumed it. Yet it has now been banned because it was found to be dangerous to our health. Other red dyes have been substituted for it. Hundreds of foods are colored with red dyes. The dyes make them look good. They help sales. Which are also controversial.
You look on the label of bologna salami, in small print you'll find the word sodium nitrite. This is one of the additives to stay away from. Sodium nitrite itself isn't so dangerous. The problem arises when sodium nitrite reacts with other chemicals, either in the foods or in our stomach, to create nitrosamines. And tiny amounts of nitrosamines have been found to cause cancer in animals.
Food processors say sodium nitrite is needed for curing meat and to prevent botulism bacteria from growing. However, often it's used simply to give meats a bright pinkish color to increase their sales appeal. Many scientists and others think it should be banned for this purpose. One place where it is definitely unnecessary is in baby food. A few years ago, another additive, monosodium glutamate, MSG, was widely used in baby foods. The purpose was to increase sales by making the food more tasty to mothers. When doubts arose about the safety of MSG for babies, the manufacturers fought against removing it. Eventually, they were forced to, but there was no need for it to have been there in the first place. Today, each of us takes in an average of 5 pounds of additives a year. Some clearly serve no legitimate need and should be eliminated from our food.
We need to be very careful in, I think, preventing the indefinite multiplication of additives in our food supply. We have more than 2,000 now. On the other hand, to damn them all indiscriminately to be ignorant of the fact that in some cases they increase rather than decrease the safety of the food supply.
Still another change in our eating habits is the high percentage of sugar in our diet. By eating a lot of sugar, we invite tooth decay and other health problems. Yet many of us have a sweet tooth, and food processors are happy to encourage it.
Now, I don't think people do realize how much sugar they have in their diet, because there's so much sugar hidden in foods. As something simple as ketchup and tomato sauce. There's sugar in soup, and sugar in sausages. Some of our cured meats have sugar in them. We eat about 114 pounds of sugar a year per person. The largest amount of sugar used is in beverages.
A 12-ounce bottle of America's favorite soft drink has 7, 8, 9 teaspoons of sugar. Americans are on a sugar drink binge. We annually consume more sugar drinks than milk and fruit juices combined. Peaches are a good dessert, but when they are packed in a heavy syrup, you get 4 teaspoons of sugar per serving. In many cases, we have substituted sugar-based products for more nutritious ones. Artificially colored and flavored breakfast drinks have not only more sugar, but fewer vitamins and none of the minerals that real fruit juices have. Ingredients in a food are listed in order by weight. If sugar is first, it means it's the largest item in the food. Some breakfast cereals are almost 50% sugar.
Well, I like Brix and Kale Chocolate and Cheerios and blueberries.
Yeah. I like blueberries better than the Fruit Loops. They're sweet and they make you have a blue nose.
I like Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah.
And Fruit Loops.
Yeah, as you can see, the sugar ones always seem to win out.
Sugar Bear.
Yes, Sugar Fox?
I got Super Sugar Crisp and you can't have any.
Is it yummy?
Right.
Yummy for your tummy?
Right.
Frankenberry has strawberry flavored sweeties.
Count Chocula has chocolate sweeties.
Highly advertised. Very tasty. The kids love it. Mothers buy it because they like it. Kids see it advertised on TV. And it's a circle that's been very difficult for us to break. And as nutritionists and home economists, we talk about trying to improve our food supply and trying to improve our food buying. And yet we have tremendous forces from our advertising media to buy these products.
Food advertising has considerable means, about $1.5 billion on media, about $3 billion total. It serves a very different function from advertising in general. In general, advertising tends to increase consumption of certain goods and then shift preference to certain brands. In the case of food, however, the total amount of food you're going to eat is independent of the amount of advertising you see. All advertising does is shift your food supply or your food intake from one type of food to another.
We can think of foods in 4 different groups, with nutrition declining from group to group. And the first group would be vegetables, fruits, eggs, milk, cheese, meat, and whole wheat products. And the second, white bread, potatoes, macaroni products, some of the better breakfast cereals, and soups. And the third, and now nutritional value is going down rapidly, sugar-coated breakfast cereals, some snack foods, cake mixes, and so forth. And in the fourth, candy, soft drinks, and many snack foods. However, if we ate these foods in proportion to the advertising given to them, this is how much we might eat from each group.
Advertising really is to try to shift the food preferences of Americans from the better foods to the worse foods, and I'm afraid it's very successful at it. All the data we have on nutrient consumption by the American people show that since 1955, there has been a real deterioration in the food supply as consumed, and I think advertising is very responsible for it.
We have a choice. We can eat the factory foods that are pushed on us by advertising, or we can save money and eat better with more unprocessed natural foods.
Mix
it up a little bit.
Here you are,
Robin.
This is a beautiful man.
Oh,
Oh, wow.
Oh, those colors.
Whatever it is, it's great.
Oh, I wish I had more room.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
We have with us today to discuss the film that you just saw, our own Jack Schierenbeck. Jack was a former lecturer and consultant for a government agency concerned with food and nutrition. Jack, what's your reaction to the film? Did it give an accurate picture of problems of food, health, and nutrition in the United States?
Well, I think it's good as far as it goes, but I think it doesn't provide us with answers, nor does it really raise some more fundamental questions about the relationship between nutrition and health.
Well, let's ask some of these fundamental questions. What caused these problems of nutrition and health vis-a-vis food that we saw in the movie? What's the origins of this?
Well, I think you first have to begin that before malnutrition, before obesity and cancer and heart disease, was a much more fundamental problem for people, basically starvation. I mean, hunger has been with us since the dawn of time. My own ancestors, many died in the Irish famine of 1846 and 1847. There was a lot of rain those 2 years, but the boats still left the ports of Ireland with cattle and grain headed for the New World and for markets. So the hunger has always been with us. But what's happened what's changed is in the 20th century, people's willingness to accept hunger as part of the natural order of things has changed. They're not willing to tolerate starvation, and they've organized, and workers have organized, to get a better standard of living.
So this means that there's an increased demand for food, that people are now demanding more food than before because there's less of a toleration for just letting people starve. How has this affected food production, this increased demand for food?
Well, there are two things. It's not only a demand for food, but it's also less of a willingness in the 20th century for people to continue to do the kind of back-breaking drudgery from dawn to dusk that people have done for thousands of years in the scramble for existence. So what you have here are essentially two pressures. One is a demand for food, and two is a rising unwillingness for people to submit to work or declining willingness to work.
You mean farmers and the agricultural producers?
Yeah, generally, yes. People unwilling to work as hard, as put as much time into farming.
So what is their solution then, or their response to increase their toil?
Well, what has been is essentially this. You see a staggering increase in the productivity of agriculture in the United States with mechanization. I mean, the output of labor, farm labor, has gone up tremendously in the 20th century. As the farm population has shrank from 40% in 1930 down to 4% in 1980. Okay, but that has had some nasty consequences in terms of this mechanization is essentially a response to the pressures for people for more food, mm-hmm. but has led to introduce machinery and technologies which have a disastrous effect in terms of the purity of the foods on people's health.
Is there a similar situation vis-a-vis food processing?
Oh.
Have these pressures affected that as well?
Without a doubt. The fields are just the first step. You have the middleman, the processing. Mechanization has also been a feature of food processing industry. As workers have struggled and to get better wages and working conditions. Food industry has been only too willing to replace them with machines. But now you essentially have to create vegetables and fruits that which can withstand mechanical harvesting. And also, in many ways, the pressure for more food has led to the production of more synthetic food in order to reduce the cost of food.
So there's been all these artificial foods, and as well as certain kind of junk foods, that simply respond to the pressure for more food at a lower cost to the food producer.
Absolutely.
So this is the origin of it. Jack, I'm wondering now what the solution to this problem is. Some people say in order to get a risk-proof food supply, that is healthy, safe food, you have to turn the clock back to go to sort of earlier forms of agricultural production without pesticides, creating organic foods, using natural foods. Is this really the solution to the problem of food today in the world?
Well, first of all, that's the line that you get from industry, that essentially we'd be turning the clock back. We'd have to have 75% of the population out cultivating their own food. No, that's not the case. In fact, I think we can keep the benefits of mechanization, but also introduce into the process accountability and make some shifts in terms of the kind of machinery we're using, where we won't have to have these nasty side effects that we're talking about.
What were some other examples of that shift in production bee that would produce better food?
Well, for instance, right now we lose 1 million acres a year of arable farmland to unplanned tract development. Now, that obviously any solution to the food crisis would begin by saying, well, we've got to think about not losing our arable farmland.
So preserving the land. What would the role of the government be in all this?
Well, the role of the government... The role of the government has been like a wrestling match. There's been lots of grunts and groans between the government and industry, but very few people have gotten hurt. That's not to say that there aren't people in government who are well-meaning, well-intentioned, and are trying to protect the consumer. However, they're faced with an uphill battle. They are outgunned by industry. Essentially, industry fights them in the courts at tooth and nail at every turn, and essentially flaunts the government role of protecting the consumer.
Isn't it a bit elitist, indeed, to depend on a government bureaucracy to dictate what food will be produced and what food people should eat in America? How would you answer this comment that I know people in the food industry make?
You're right. They make it all the time. Sort of conjure up the specter of a big brother totalitarian government dictating to the people what they should be eating. Well, no one's for dictatorship, no one's for big brother totalitarianism, but they have to answer the fact that over $3 billion is spent every year by the food industry, together with Wall Street ad men, to attempt to kind of manipulate people's consciousness to shape consumer preferences. I mean, that is a subtler form of brainwashing. And any time anybody seeks to pose an alternative to that, immediately the specter of big government is employed by industry. I think it's sheer...
Well, let's focus on the role of television and advertising in producing food consumption. What do you think its impact is, television advertising?
Well, television advertising, it's fairly straightforward. The average child is... bombarded by every year 20,000 commercials. The biggest advertisers on TV are the food companies. Now, I'm not one to conjure up conspiracy theories, but it doesn't take a genius or a giant leap of faith to understand that the media is not going to bite the hand that feeds them.
And that a lot of these ads are for junk food that create needs and demands for these unhealthy foods in children who put pressure on their parents.
Yes, but I don't want to leave it at that. I think the situation on television is much more mixed than that. Mm-hmm. I think it has been television and the media in general, which has been one of the things responsible for the growing consumer awareness and concern about the adulteration of the food supply.
Television news and documentaries.
Yeah, and also panel shows. You really can't watch Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin or the like without somebody talking about diet and coming on and talking about basically the health consequences of what we eat.
Jack, what is the role of the scientific and the medical and the academic profession been? Have they done the research that we need to know what food is safe and what isn't? Have they communicated to the general public these findings? What has their role in all this been?
Well, I think your average grandmother knows more than your average doctor about nutrition. The New York Times did a survey in 1976, which found that out of 120 medical schools, only 12 had part of their curriculum nutrition education. So essentially, doctors don't know very much about the links between what we eat and what we are, our general health. I know that I've gone to Sloan Kettering Memorial Clinic. It's probably the premier cancer hospital in the world. And if you went into the lunchroom and watched what the doctors and nurses eat, you would really understand why they're not interested in prevention. They're more interested in the pound of treatment rather than the ounce of
So it's in their interests to keep a high disease level from a poorly fed public.
No, I mean, that's the argument that is made. The argument mm-hmm. is made that the medical and pharmaceutical industries mm-hmm. are making a profit out of it, therefore.
Right.
I don't think they're evil people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they generally have gone to school and have a very narrow view of what constitutes health. Fact of the matter is our medical profession knows how to treat disease.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know anything, virtually anything, mm-hmm. about what constitutes health.
Well, what about the research establishment, the university or the scientific community? Haven't they learned the basic facts about this to teach the doctors and to the public to help solve these problems?
No,
I think if
you went into a nutrition department in any university in this country, you would see them riddled with corporate conflict of interest. For the most part, all of them are on retainer to the giant food corporations. Even Jean Meyer, who was pictured in the film, is himself on the board of Monsanto, which creates these chemicals themselves, which are part of the additives in our food supply. So, again, it's really an insidious situation.
It's a vicious circle, it seems.
Yes, it
like.
Is.
Jack, let's try to get back to the solution to this problem. The film suggested that wiser consumer choices was really the problem, that if the public learned more about nutrition, made more attempts to buy healthy food, maybe went the health food route or the organic food route or bought all their food from health food stores or co-ops, they wouldn't be subjected to the junk food, the unhealthy food, and thus they would have better health and a better nutrients in their diet. What's your answer to this solution?
Well, I wish it was as easy as that, but I think it begins from a certain misunderstanding about the role that food plays in our society. The role food plays in our society is essentially a rational one from the perspective of business. Let's look at it for instance. I happen to shop at a health food store, okay? It costs me a lot of money to shop at a health food store. I have orange juice every morning, fresh squeezed, and it costs me about 75 cents. I can afford that. I'm willing to pay that. But if I had three or four kids, could I be forking up $3 or $4 every morning before I even started breakfast to have orange juice?
Isn't there a time factor here, too, that sort of junk food and prefabricated food, TV dinner syndrome, sort of follows the logic of the workday with more and more people having to work? There's less and less time to produce food.
That's without a doubt. People come home after the grind of a hard day's work. It's very easy to have somebody in the film kind of stand there and sort of say, talk about the glories of organic cooking. But that takes time and it takes preparation. And most people just don't have the time nor the money
mm-hmm.
to be able to afford health food. No, I don't think that we're going to be able to accomplish this through the market system. I think it's going to require not individual solutions, but
mm-hmm.
broader societal and political solutions.
Well, let's start talking about that. What sort of political changes do we need to deal with this problem?
Well, it won't be politics as usual.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm not saying is that we ought to create more laws, because there already are laws on the book. But as I said, corporations have an, have enormous resources at their disposal to essentially circumvent these laws. Let's take, for instance, the problem of chemical adulteration of the food. Right now, there are over 35,000 pesticides loose on the environment, most of which have never been examined by the Food and Drug Administration themselves. So, we're left with, do we need more laws to regulate? No, we don't. The Food and Drug Administration doesn't have the manpower, doesn't have the money, they're overworked, and there really isn't sort of the statutory teeth. Similarly, another problem, and I think the problem of chemicals in our society is a much more evasive one. I think it evades the usual ideas that we can pass laws to solve social problems.
Well, what's the solution then to the problem of chemicals? You're saying that laws and regulations won't work. What do we need to deal with the problem?
Well, let me finish on this. The reason I suggest that laws enough will not be sufficient is this. Chemicals, and we have over 500 new chemicals produced every year on the market, okay, to have a long incubation period. That is, it may have disastrous health consequences, but 25 or 30 years down the road. Mm-hmm. It's not like biting on a cyanide capsule, you keel over. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the ingestion of hazardous substances which have a long-term cumulative health hazard risk.
Are you suggesting a moratorium on these very chemicals?
Absolutely. I'm suggesting that we need right now an across-the-board moratorium on the production of new chemicals.
That simply we shouldn't use these dangerous chemicals any longer and shouldn't use new ones before they are tested.
Well, I think that a chemical, essentially, should be guilty until it's proven innocent.
Well, what kind of a system would we need for this to take place? What should be the position of the food corporations vis-a-vis food production?
Well, obviously, food corporations are going to fight this tooth and nail because it essentially is going to limit their flexibility. It's going to reduce their ability to cut costs and gain profitability. But it's a question of whether human need, people's need for a food system which is abundant, safe, and affordable, or whether or not profit will be the determining factor of what the food that we eat.
So it's a question of social accountability and perhaps social cost as well.
Well, social cost, it's interesting you talk about social cost, because the reason I think that this cannot be accomplished through the market system is that right now we're spending almost $200 billion a year on medical care. We know that a lot of that medical care is essentially to help clean up the mess that's already been created. We need to be doing more preventive, taking more preventive steps. But it's not preventive medicine. We need a preventive politics that begins to sort of raise fundamental questions, not just about food, but to see the relationship between food and the broader society.
So, Jack, in conclusion, you made a provocative statement earlier that we have the resources and wherewithal to create an abundant, safe, and affordable food supply in the future. So you think that this is a problem, food, hunger, starvation, health, that can be dealt with?
Absolutely. I don't think it's a technical problem. I believe it's a political problem.
Well, let's hope we have the political response to deal with this problem. Thank you very much, Jack.
Thank you.
The same thing that's happening in our general economy, that's happening in automobiles and tires and various other commodities, is now beginning to happen in food. We've got a situation where now just, they said, as you pointed out earlier, in 1968, they said the merger movement was over. We should not worry about the economic structure of the food economy because all those mergers were over. Well, not only is it not over, it has become a great deal worse. In 1965, the top 50 firms, top 50 food processors, produced 50% of the profits. They had half of the profits in the food industry, which was already a very high level of concentration, higher than most of our people realize. By 1975, when I wrote this book, that level of profit concentration had risen to 75%. The top 50 companies then controlled 75%. Today, the top 50 companies control 90% of the profits in the food industry. So that concentration really is proceeding dramatically. You might wonder who some of these companies are, and that's not always easy to find out, because food now is a product of consumer product conglomerates, they call themselves, and very few of them have food even as their primary resource. The two largest are not even American corporations, which will drive you xenophobes crazy. And they've achieved this not by inventing a better mousetrap, as we're taught is the way you gain success in our economy, but because they're cash rich and because they have the power, the raw financial power, to buy the sweat and the innovation of individual entrepreneurs. And that's what's happened over, about the last 20 years in particular. It's been aggressive. And it's going to continue to happen. Just last year, you heard one of them already, now it's no longer a matter of little companies, little local companies being bought up. Now instead it's national companies are subject to these mergers. In 1978, Del Monte was bought by R.J. Reynolds. Pet Foods was bought by IC Industries, which used to be the Illinois Central Railroad, except now they're not in the railroad business anymore. Tropicana was bought by Beatrice. Green Giant was bought by Pillsbury. And 7-Up was bought by Philip Morris. So now it's that level of economic concentration that we're dealing with. Beatrice, in the last 25 years, Beatrice Food made 400 acquisitions. They bought 400 individual companies. Now, they don't refer to those even as companies now. They call them profit centers within their own conglomerate. They're financial machines, and that's the way that, let me just read to you, the way that the R.J. Reynolds, which is a major food conglomerate now, I forget what all they own, but a whole host of things. Now they own Del Monte, among others. But the chief financial officer of R.J. Reynolds describes his firm as an enormously powerful financial machine. Plain and simple. Not a food company, not a conglomerate. It is a financial machine. There, it doesn't matter whether they make tennis balls or what. Some say they do make tennis balls. They could as well be making tennis balls as they're making food. It doesn't matter what they're in as far as telling money. Now, he says, we'll probably have $1 billion in cash and borrowing capacity to buy more companies over the next 5 years. He says they'll be able to do that, plus meet ongoing demands for cash, pay shareholders an appropriate dividend, and still be a positive cash generator. That is a level of economic power that we've not been used to facing in our economy. But now we're really head-to-head with it, because now we have virtual monopolies in the food economy. Those monopolies face farmers when they go to market to sell their food, then they turn, and in the supermarket, they face each one of us.
And as Jim Hightower predicted, monopoly has increased in the food industry since he made this program with us back in 79. We'd like to thank our crew, our camera person Eric Eubank, our audio man Kevin L. West, and of course Austin Community Television, ACTV, for the use of their equipment. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. So there's our address. If you'd like to write to us, that'd be nice. We'd like to hear from you. Goodbye.